Welcome back to another episode of Broken, the Suspicious Death of Aladar and the End of Horse Racing's Golden Age. I'm your host, Denise Cueto.
And I'm Fred Cray, author.
Tell us a little bit about what's been going on lately.
How is your investigation like? Did you, as you were out there in the country visiting, trying to talk to people who might not want the story to come out, what was your experience?
Well, my experience was I went out to J.T. Lundy's house.
Were you able to meet him?
I was able to meet him. You know, when I went out there, when I started this, I thought, I'll never find him. And the reason I say that is when the bankruptcy was going on, when the trials, nobody could find him. And he was hiding in Ocala at a horse farm. And you can't get into a horse farm without knowing the pad, you know, the keypad number. There's a big horse gate across there. And he was hiding behind that. And even for Alton Stone's trial, they couldn't subpoena him. And so he was never able to testify anywhere because they couldn't serve him a subpoena. So when I got to Lexington and I started asking around, it was pretty clear that everybody knew where he lived. It wasn't hard to find him. You know, it's an open secret of where he lives. So I drove out to his house and I remember it was dark and it was drizzly and cold. And I thought to myself, you know, this is typical. This is a typical, you know, way of going out. That it was kind of dreary and eerie. And I was on one hand, I felt excited because maybe he would talk to me. I mean, it's been so long. Nothing's going to happen to him now. And on the other hand, I thought, well, maybe he'll just say nothing, you know. So, you know, I pulled up, you know, checked the address. It's a 1,500 square foot house. It's kind of old on a small lot. There was a truck in the driveway. I walked up onto his porch and looked. He's got a horse knocker on his door. And he's got a door that has three little windows in it. And I look in and I see him sitting in a little chair watching a cathode ray TV, you know, one of those old tube TVs.
Oh, boy.
On the wall, on the far wall, is a picture of a horse. I can't tell if it's Aladar or what, but it's a painting. It's clearly, you know, a good painting, an original painting. I knock on the door. I don't use the knocker because I'm a little, you know, it sounds like it's going to be too loud. He comes over the door, opens it, and I go, J.T. Lundy? And he says, yes, sir. And he says it like he's in the military. And I think, was he in the military? I don't know. And so I said, look, I'm writing a book about Aladar. And he interrupts me and says, as he's shaking his head, and he says, I don't want nothing to do with it. And his face is getting red, and he's frowning, and you can see he's losing his temper. And I go, hey, I understand. And I kind of stand there to wait to see if anything else is going to, you know, like sometimes you wait around, some he'll say something else. So you could see he's getting madder. And finally, in a burst of profanity, he said, fuck that shit. It's all on paper. And then he looked at me like to accuse me of being on his porch, you know. There was a part of me was saying, this could be the answer to the puzzle. And I was hoping that that's what it'd be. And then after that, it was fear because he was angry and I didn't know how far that would go. Once he said he wasn't going to talk, my feeling was I want to get out of here. I don't want him to, you know, get a gun or get mad or try to push me off the porch. I was really in an emotional place. How I felt, it was all emotional there. And I said, okay, you know, and I backed up. And then as I walked off the porch, he kind of turned around and looked at me and he said, I'm sorry, I can't help you. And he said it in a way like he was really sincerely sorry he couldn't help me. So to me, it was just this kaleidoscope of emotions all at once. Anger, you know, indignation and, you know, being sorry. And it was just it was so strange to me. And I left and that was it.
So you mentioned that it was emotional for you. I mean, what was going on in your mind? Why was it emotional? What happened as you were leaving?
Well, anyone who knows me knows that I'm a very sensitive person. And I'm not joking. I mean, I've just always been that way. I've always been concerned about reading the room, feeling, you know, what people are feeling, and, you know, so I really got an angry vibe from him. I was fearful of what might happen, and any hope that I had of him telling me something that actually happened was gone. And so when I left, I was disappointed. I really didn't understand why he wouldn't say something because, you know, 35 years have passed. He can't go to jail. Nothing's going to happen. People think the worst of J.T. Lundy. The FBI guy thinks he did it. He's the one who killed Aladar, broke his leg. So there's almost nothing Lundy could say that could be worse than what people think. And so I don't understand if he didn't do it or if he has other information that would implicate someone else in having made the decision. Why would he not do that?
And when you say he seemed apologetic, why? I mean, obviously, I'm asking you to put yourself in his. Why would he be apologetic?
Well, because I think there is a part of him that does care that and does know that I've driven all the way out to his house on a rainy night. A normal person would, you know, be helpful, but he just this particular thing is something that I guess has haunted him, and he's going to take it to his grave.
Who is J.T. Lundy?
J.T. Lundy is the person who was managing Calumet from like 1980 to 1990. And he married, J.T. Lundy married one of the farm heirs, Cindy Wright. And that's how he got control of Calumet, because Cindy Wright was one of four heirs. And the four heirs had no horse experience. So they said, well, J.T. Lundy had his own farm at Midway. Let's let him run the farm. And they gave him a 10-year contract to run the farm. And so what's interesting is that it wasn't an accident that he married Cindy. He planned to marry Cindy in order to get into Calumet and run it. He had told friends that this was his plan, was to get to marry Calumet's heirs and get control of the farm. He married Cindy, but Mrs. Markey was still alive. She had to die before he could take over. As she got older, he started writing letters complaining about how they were handling the farm and telling everybody that he was going to fire everyone when she died. And when she died, the next working day, he came in and took over like a bulldozer and fired all the people that were there who had been there for decades. John Veach quits.
My tenure of the trainer of Aladar, it was every day. 24 hours a day. I saw him. I lived with him.
Yep.
And then in the few years after he was retired and was at stud at Calumet Farm, and every time that I have the opportunity to be at Calumet Farm, I spent as much time around him as I possibly could because he was very much a part of my life. Went and visited him as long as Mrs. Markey was alive.
Yep.
Just to visit an old friend.
Yes.
Saw him in the paddock. I saw him in the stallion barn. Visited him as much as I could. I saw no change in his demeanor. A lot of colts, once they become stallions, become very, very aggressive.
Yes.
And change their demeanor.
Yes.
But I did not denote that or see that in Aladar at all. I mean, basically, I would always feed Aladar sugar, cubes of sugar or peppermints and things like that. And even when he was out in his paddock and as a stallion in breeding, he would always come over to me, remember me, not, I guess, visually, but he could probably remember the peppermint and the sugar.
Right.
And I would sit on the fence and feed them at, and also I would do the same thing when he was in the barn as a stallion.
Aladar is a successful racehorse. He races for many years, and then he is now siring horses, correct?
He's called Going Out to Stud.
Going Out to Stud.
Yeah.
Hello.
Charlie.
Yeah.
How's it going, man?
Okay.
Well, that's good. Now, there came a time when you had to say goodbye. When Aladar retired off the track,
yeah,
there was an article in the New York Times about, you know, you being there saying goodbye.
Right.
And,
in fact, somebody sent me that as a Christmas present, me with almost a tear in my eye and leading Aladar onto the van.
Yeah.
You know, I've experienced this so many times with other horses.
Yeah.
You know, that you get close to and then the career is over and they have to go. So I was glad to see him go, but you were still were happy he was going on to a better life and a carefree life as a stud and not have to do any work like he did. It was a part of my life that I knew was going to be with me forever, you know? Like I said, yeah, he was charismatic and intelligent. Allie thought he just wanted to do everything that I wanted to do. He was as kind as could be. You know, people calling me 40 years later to talk about it, and they still do.
Yeah.
Every year when Derby time comes around, I just count on getting called. Although they're becoming fewer now because most of the people that were involved are gone, you know?
Yeah.
Not a lot of us left.
Yeah.
Charlie Rose was Al Dar's exercise rider. An exercise rider is one that rides the horse for practice, because what happens, you know, the jockey doesn't generally ride the horse for practice. Generally, the jockey shows up at the track, gets on the horse for the race, runs, and that's it. Charlie was the one who rode Aladar the most, and they had a wonderful relationship. Charlie loved Aladar, and he's a very sweet, gentle man. And when you talk to him or you see him, you think to yourself, I can see why Aladar would love Charlie Rose, because he always cared about the horse and he always, you know, wanted to make sure the horse was comfortable when he was, whatever he was doing. They used a special soft bit for his mouth so that it would be comfortable for him. Before Charlie Rose was the exercise rider, he didn't start until I think the second or third race, but there was another guy riding him. And whenever he was practicing, Aladar would lather up and get all nervous. And when Charlie Rose got on him for the first time, that stopped. And so it was very interesting, you know, how much they bonded.
I walked down it. He was like way over at the other end of the paddock. And I thought, hey, Allie. And his head came up. And he came running as fast as he could. and he put on the brakes right when he got to the rail. I said, oh, my God, he's going to run through the rail.
Yeah.
Next to me, you know. And he put on the brakes, and he stood there, and he reared up, and he was pawing the ground, and he was just overexcited.
Did you talk to him?
No, I don't remember if I did or not, because I was so nervous right then. I said, I don't, he's $30 million horses. He's short for $30 million. If he gets hurt, it's because of me. And I did not stay, but he followed me all the way back as far as he could. Along the fence. And I went back in the office and I told him, you know, wow, I came running to me, but I had to get out of there because he was getting too excited that I was there. And that, you know, that's unusual with horses.
How did you feel about it? How did that make you feel?
Oh, I was happy. I was delighted. But, you know, once I got over the nervous feeling, because he was in danger of hurting himself.
Yeah. You know?
So, it was a good feeling that he remembered me and he reacted to me that way.
When Aladar retired from horse racing because he had an injury and was taken to Calumet Farm, Dennis Yoakum, he was his groom for like 2 or 3 months, and he told me that Aladar was injured, and they put him in the training barn, not the stallion barn, and they put him under an assumed name.
Well, when he came to the farm, he had on a halter that did not say Aladar on it. I can tell you that. he came back to the farm as Darren Stone. That was the name on the halter. That was the name on the door. He went to the training barn, and he stayed in the training barn. Hmm. He did not go to the stallion barn. He was not sound, and they did not want to showcase him when he wasn't sound, and so he just stayed in the training barn.
Well, I have read that. I mean, he did retire because he had an injury, and he wasn't running well. He ran with a bar on one of his hoofs, and you know, they tried to put him on turf, and that didn't, you know, that didn't work out well, and they just decided to retire him.
We used to kind of joke that you know, Veach must have given him a Veach's guys must have given him a sugar cube every time they put a halter on him or something, because he was always grabbing at you.
Yeah,
you know but he was he wasn't just being playful, but he wasn't mean. He wasn't going after you,
right?
You know, he was just, it's almost like he was wondering who was in charge that day. Was it you or was it him?
Yeah.
You know, somebody's in charge. We're not sure who it is.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
But he wasn't mean.
And then that takes us to 1990.
Right. So he raced, 78, 79. He retired. He went out to stud at Calumet, and he became a fantastic horse in terms of raising kids that were great. So, you know, he had Ali Sheba, he had Easy Goer, and those two horses collectively won the Triple Crown that he never won. And he had some other horses too, but he beat Affirmed in the Breeding Shed by a far greater margin than Affirmed beat him in the racing. And so he was such a fertile stallion, virile stallion. His breeding, to breed with him, could cost up to $250,000 per cover. And he made millions of dollars for Calumet breeding. And so that took us through, you know, the time that he retired up until 1990. He was still in 1990 at the age of 15, breeding to, you know, a lot of horses per year, probably more than any other horse. I mean, we're talking about 80 to 100 horses, which was unheard of in 1990. In 1990, the standard was 50. But Lundy wanted to make all the money he possibly could off of Aladar. And so he bred him as much as he could.
What was it that led Calumet to be in dire financial straits? You would think that they would be doing great. What happened?
J.T. Lundy.
The timeline from the standpoint of J.T. Lundy took control, it was in August. J.T. Lundy and I was at Saratoga with the racing stable. J.T. Lundy came to Saratoga, informed me that they were taking control, and that they would give me the orders from that point on.
Right.
In September of that year, I tendered my resignation, knowing that I did not want to have any association with J.T. Lundy. I didn't really think that that they were capable of ever carrying on the tradition of something I was very proud to be associated with. I walked away from them.
Well, you sure turned out to be right.
Well, J.T. was a little man that thought he was bigger than he really was, and he did squander and actually bankrupt a very, very fine institution that really was part of the tradition of thoroughbred racing in America or in the world. And I realized that that he didn't have the that he was not a good man, and that he was not a person that could ever fulfill the ideals of something I was very proud to be part of at one time. Everybody that knew JT, before he got the management and control of Calumet Farm or after, realized that he was never up to the game.
Yeah.
And or his position, and that his ego far outruns his knowledge or his character. You got to understand that Calumet Farm was like a family.
Yeah.
And I'm basically talking about not the horses or the farm or the land, but the people that were there.
Mm-hmm.
The people that were there, most of them spent their entire working lives at Calumet Farm because they were so proud to be part of such a great organization. It was like being part of the New York Yankees.
Yeah.
JT basically took a broom and swept everybody that had been loyal and had worked at Calumet Farm and, you know, just wanted to have his own people there.
So from the 1940s to the 1960s, Calumet Farm was unparalleled in racing dominance. They had 8 Kentucky Derbies and 2 Triple Crowns during that time. And you're looking at a Whirl Away in 1941 won the Triple Crown. Then Coaltown in 1948 was a champion horse of the year. Then Citation 7 years later wins another Triple Crown. And then in 1957, that's 5 years later, Iron Liege wins the Kentucky Derby. In 1958, Tim Tam wins the Kentucky Derby. So from 1941 to 1958, they were just unstoppable. And then after that, 58, they had another Kentucky Derby winner in 68, but they went downhill after that. And that was, again, as I said earlier, because the owners, Lucille Markey and her husband, were more into socializing. It wasn't until 1975 that they got back to, we need a horse for the farm to come back to dominance. And that's what they put all their hopes on Aladar. That's what made John Veitch such a nervous trainer, because he knew that that pressure was on him. Mm.
So after Aladar's death, we said he was Calumet. So what happened to Calumet?
Well, Calumet went bankrupt about 6 months after he died. Aladar died on November 15th. On April Fool's Day, Lundy quits of the next year. Hmm. He'd been thinking about quitting for a long time, but that's when he actually had written his resignation letter a month before and kept it in his pocket. You know, when the bank met with him to try to figure out how they're going to pay all these loans off, he quit, and John Ward took over, and within the next 3 or 4 months, Calumet had to declare bankruptcy because they owed $120 million.
You mentioned John Ward. Can you tell us who he is?
John Ward is a lifelong horseman, and he actually was the Kentucky Derby trainer for Monarcos, who went on to win the Kentucky Derby. He's famous in his own right, but in terms of this podcast, John Ward took the farm over thinking and hoping that he could get Calumet back into business even after Lundy left, because he thought the farm was $60 million in debt. And, you know, in the months he took over afterwards, he found out that that figure was double, you know, $120 million, $130 million. And he realized he wasn't going to be able to bring the farm back from that much debt. He knew the complete financial picture of Calumet after Lundy left and all of the debt and loans that they had. And so he was important in that respect, but he's also important because he told me for the first time how Aladar could have been injured in a way that was intentional. And that had never been disclosed, not even in the trials. And it was a bombshell to me.
Hello.
Hey, John.
How are you?
I'm good, and I want to appreciate you for taking your time out. I know you're a busy guy with many important things to do.
I am from a family that was very involved, or still in racing and training. My grandfather was a trainer. My father was a trainer. My uncle, Hall of Fame trainer. And so, essentially, I was born into the business, more or less.
So the burning question for everyone in this case is, how could this have been done, in an intentional way?
To do this horse's right hind, if you took this horse, where he is, and you stood him over against the smooth wall, okay?
Yeah.
Do you understand what I'm doing? Okay. You slid that door open just a little bit.
Yeah.
You pulled his hind leg out. You closed the door back.
Mm-hmm.
And you kept pressure against it. When he tried to pull his leg out of there, they can't do it. So he would have had, once you do that and he started to struggle, he would have fallen down.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the rotation of him falling down and that door being against him, in my mind, my theory, is that's what have caused the break.
This podcast is going to continue the work, take us on a journey to understand what happened to Aladar, and hopefully solve the mystery about what happened that night, determine was it just an accident or was he killed for the insurance money? Thank you so much for joining us on another episode of Broken, the Suspicious Death of Aladar and the End of Horse Racing's Golden Age. I'm your host, Denise.
And I'm Fred, the author, and I want you to make sure that you tell your friends and go on social media and spread the word about Aladar and Broken and our podcast.
We look forward to talking to you guys next episode. Be sure to tune in for some more information. This episode was produced by Ashley York and John Fee, mixed and edited by John Fee. David Amani is our production assistant.
We'll see you next time on Broken, the podcast.